Senate Committee on Health Policy to order. This is March 28, 2005, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 771. And Senator Morissette, would you like to open this up? Do you want to give a brief introduction to it? Mr. Bercovian.
Thank you, Senator. Just briefly, you have in the packet before you the measure summary for 771, but attached to the dash one amendments. And since these amendments are coming from Senator Morissette, they'll be treated as the actual bill today. So I've included with your packet kind of a bulleted list of the dash one amendments. In your packet. And there's also a letter from a Mr. Wright from Eugene who's speaks to the bill in your packet. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Let's have Senator Morissette just give a few comments as to how this bill came about from his point of view.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is introduced on behalf of Drake Edwards, the director of SAFE, which is in Springfield, which is a self-help program for people with mental illness. And basically, it's a consumer affairs bill that allows people to have a greater say in how they're dealt with. And there are a lot of people here to testify, so I'll just let it go at that. And thank you very much for hearing the bill.
Yes, we do have 15 people signed up to testify on this. And the reason I really got excited about this bill is I'm a part of the team that's working on the cremains that are at the Oregon State Psychiatric Hospital, and we had some consumers involved there, past people who had been in the state hospital and are out, and also advocates, and they had such meaningful and wonderful input to give regarding that very issue itself. And I think that's a population that maybe we have neglected, and I feel very strongly that we should have a consumer group that we can give input on. We have treated our mentally ill, they have had a stigma in the past, and we want to help change that. And hopefully this will be one way to do that. So I would like to call Bob Nickel and Gina Furman. Let's start with you two first.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator of the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I've provided written testimony, so I'm not going to read it to you. You have plenty of other people to hear from, but I want to go on record as being in full support of Senate Bill 771. We had to make some cuts a couple of years ago in which we cut out some of the very functions that this bill would replace, and we have not had the kind of consumer activist voice within the office that I think that I would like to have. I have been meeting with the Consumer Council informally for the past nearly 2 years, and I've found that Consumer Council to be very helpful to me in thinking through a variety of issues. If I did not have them to listen to, I wouldn't have the kind of forum that I've had. We are willing to absorb the costs of this Office of Consumer Affairs into our current budget, and I just want to say that I very much appreciate the introduction of this bill. I've seen the amendments, and they look acceptable to me, so I just want to go on record as being in full support of this bill.
Thank you.
May I
yes,
ask
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Mr. Nickel, unfortunately, this bill came out with a fiscal impact statement, possible fiscal impact, and I'm wondering, we're not going to have a work session, I understand, today, and is that something you can work with the LFO about it?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette.
You feel that you can, well, let me rephrase the question. You're saying that you can absorb the cost, there is no additional cost for this program within your department, is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, I should have been clearer on that. We have a zero fiscal impact as a result of this bill because we are willing to figure out a way within our current budget and our FTE to do this, and I'm very strongly in support of that.
Okay.
And just to follow up on that, we have received word from legislative fiscal that they will not rescind the referral to Ways and Means. So that's, I had planned to work session it today, so this is something that we'll work on because of, and see if we can get that rescinded.
Bob, a little confusion here. You say you can absorb this, but then you also said that a couple of years ago, due to cuts, this sort of activity ceased. Can you match that together for me?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we have a position that's recently become vacant in our office. That's the position that I would reassign to do this particular work with. The earlier contract was actually for quite a bit more money than the fiscal impact would have been if we had to create a new position. So this is, in a sense, a downscaled version of what we had before. But the advantage that I see is that this allows us to do two things. One is to have the voice directly within the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services for recovery, and also formalizes the council that I started informally.
So you have a position that's in your current budget that, well, because you say it just became, I mean, you know, we have new procedures on vacancies now, so this is one that just became vacant for some reason, but it's in your current budget, and you would hire somebody to fill that position and redirect them to this.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and we wanted to go on record supporting this bill. My concern was a fiscal impact at first, but in conversation with Becky Childs, some consumer advocates, and also Mr. Nickel, we are sure that that under the current configuration of Mr. Nichols' office, that he'll be able to take care of the things that this bill calls for. We want to tell you in the association that it is very important that we have consumer input, and we have consumers represented and here at our meetings. But I think one of the things that Mr. Nickel has done has already created this informally, and this would help put it into a statute, and it would be very, very helpful. So we're in full support, and we're really thankful for the consumers that have worked on this bill.
Yeah, one more question for Bob, I guess. Looking at the dash one, and it you have a council of 15 to 25. That seems large to me. You know, I mean, my experience with committees and groups like that, you can reach economies of scale that make it less productive than it should be. Why such a big number?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I've been used to working with a mental health advisory council of 48 members. I did shave that down to about 25, and partly because of my experience working with large committees, 15 to 25 seems like something that's doable, and it's about, frankly, the number of consumers who've been attending on a regular basis, and it's been a very manageable process.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Go with Becky Child, and this is the fourth one. Okay, Ann Casper and Drake Eubank. Okay. And since we have so many, if you can keep your comments 3 to 5 minutes would be great. Becky, do you want to go first?
Sure.
Okay.
Madam Chair, fellow committee members, my name is Becky Child, and I live at 1218 Southwest Washington, number 319, Portland, Oregon, 97205. I am a consumer survivor of mental health services and an advocate for people who use mental health services in Oregon. I'm a member of the Real Choice Systems Change Grant Consumer Task Force and a member of the OMAS Federally Mandated Planning and Management Advisory Council. I'm here today to give you a bit of the history of how this bill came to be drafted and to urge you to adopt the amendments to Senate Bill 771 and pass it. Senate Bill 771 and House Bill 3108 came about as a result of the Real Choice Systems Change Consumer Survivor Task Force and the efforts of other consumer survivors from around the state. The task force was an advisory council that oversaw the administration of a Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Systems Change grant that was implemented to address systemic issues that prevent people with disabilities from being able to live integrated lives in the community. Carl Rear from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services was the primary author of this grant, and to whom we would like to formally thank. We were told when the grant was awarded that Oregon's grant was the highest scoring grant in the applications received and that it was the only grant at the time that addressed systemic issues for people with psychiatric disabilities. The Real Choice Systems Change grant has four major components with several projects within each of the components. Increase affordable, accessible housing, promote informed choice and consumer self-determination, provide training to consumers and family representatives, service coordinators, and service providers, and increase the availability of personal assistance and contract registered nurses. The task force has met quarterly over the past 3.5 years to hear status reports and provide feedback and suggestions. Several task force members participated in the development of requirements for RFPs and the evaluation of the RFPs for the grant. While there were several projects funded, due to time constraints, I will limit my comments to just a couple of projects. Under the first goal, to increase affordable, accessible housing, Almas made available to community mental health programs throughout the state an approximate $270,000 that was to reduce and eliminate barriers for people with psychiatric disabilities who are homeless. The barriers that people with psychiatric disabilities and who are homeless face include the inability to pay first and last month's rent deposits, security deposits, utility deposits, physically accessible housing, etc. As of December 2004, 373 individuals obtained housing, and the average dollar spent to reduce or eliminate these barriers were $367 per person, with a range from $16 up to $1,500. Task force members felt this program was a huge success, and if additional monies become available, that a priority should be to provide more assistance to individuals with psychiatric disabilities who are homeless and who have not been able to overcome these barriers. I've included a chart that you can see the distribution of those dollars. As a person who's been homeless 3 different times in my life, it's nice to see that grant dollars have had a direct impact on people's lives. Grant funds were also used to assist people with psychiatric disabilities to take charge of their life and their desires and wishes through the use of person-centered planning via employment and in directing their day-to-day life. If you ask any agency in Oregon who provides mental health services, they would all say that their services are person-centered. However, as several of us have experienced their version of person-centered, we realize that we, the consumer survivors, have a very different definition of person-centered than those who provide services to us. Therefore, the task force recommends that we use the term person-directed to indicate that the person who is receiving the services is the best expert on her or himself and that she or he should be the drivers of the services that support her or him. As a task force met over the past 3 years, there was substantial discussion as to what our role and purposes were. As someone who has sat on innumerable committees and task forces, I've developed a personal philosophy that I'm not a repository of information or a library, and I wanted us to do something with the information we were gleaning through the auspices of this grant. Task force members decided that we needed to write a paper that contained our recommendations and submit them to OMAS and its Planning and Management Advisory Council. In October 2004, the task force held a retreat and decided at the retreat that another idea that we would follow through with was to create a legislative concept that contained our most important recommendations and asked that they be adopted as statute in Oregon. So over the past several months, we have worked diligently with consumer survivors from around the state to bring this bill before you.
About 5 minutes are up, so can you sum up?
Basically, you've got a copy of the white paper and a summary paper of just the resolutions. I just lost my train of thought. Anyway, I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Child.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Ann Casper. I'm a consumer of community mental health for about 10 years off and on up in Portland. And I am here just to ask for dignity as well as accountability. I've never seen the system so bad, actually, in the past 10 years than it has been in this past year. And we just want accountability. I think having a council would help us ensure that we receive the services that we really need and are asking for. And also, just personally, I've hidden my diagnosis for 20 years. My family has, too, because of shame. We don't want people to know that this is the first time I'm going public with this. And I think having more consumers involved, we're not stupid. We may have problems sometimes, but we know how to handle ourselves and work with other people, and we want to have that power to do so. So please pass this bill so we can have that chance.
Thank you very much.
My name is Robert Drake Eubank. I go by my middle name, Drake. I'm the community liaison. I'm also on the board of a consumer-run nonprofit in Springfield, Oregon. It's called Safe Incorporated. I guess the best thing I could possibly do with so limited a time is direct your attention to the handout that I handed to the staff. I don't think I had 20 copies, but they're certainly enough for the committee members. It details how we spend the money that we get out of the Oregon Health Plan and for our other fee-for-service endeavors. What I would like to speak to is the system of care issue and how consumers figure into that. The design the governor's task force has come up with is focused on doing something about the state hospital as well as establishment of some sort of coherent system of care. To have balance in that system of care, I think, is important to have representation and actual policy input by the people that are receiving the services. And I think actually you'll find eventually that there are a lot of economies of scale that go along with that. Looking at how the budgets end up going when you're in times of limited funds, almost always in a budgetary process in health services, you start eliminating things that innovate, things that are alternative, and things that deal with prevention. And what are basically left are mandates, which are things like the hospital and unreal costs associated with emergency services and services rendered that are not on a planned and, I guess, a basis that is worked in slowly and effectively. What I would like to speak to in my few minutes up here was I would like to put the discussion on a level of how to invest in a system of care and how to use scarce resources to leverage a desired result. And I think the desired result here is have less people impacting the society, having degradation of their quality of life, and as well the budget that you guys see in the Oregon Health Plan shrinking ever more frequently each year as healthcare costs increase. Peer-run services are the most economical thing that I can point to in the system. Our standard service hour utilization is about 18 times as efficient as the healthcare system, and I can document that with statistics. We provide services that are peer-determined, not necessarily peer-delivered. We hire our own professional staff. We design our services ourselves, and we serve somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 80 clients on a regular basis and about 30 to 35 clients on a fee-for-service basis. And this is basically about $160,000 a year. Included in that documentation is exactly how we spend our money. Our administrative costs are incredibly low, and our success rate and our involvement with the clients that we serve is very much disproportionate to the level of care that they receive someplace else. I would invite you to talk to any of the people that are going to speak at any other point in this process about the way the bill was composed. We did the bill ourselves. We came up with the language of the bill, and you will get language in 3108 as an amendment that we are going to try to have instituted within the bill that you're going to eventually vote on whether to send it to the floor or not. But that is an example of a bill that was written with somebody that was knowledgeable about health services and with someone that had the time to write it. And I can't say enough about this process not being rushed to judgment in that sense, because the quality of the work that was done on the bill that's ultimately submitted here was basically with the significant input of the people receiving the services. And I think that you'll find that the things in the bill that are actually beneficial are that you're going to find economies, evidence-based practices that are being instituted right now that include consumer-run services. All those things widen the area of coverage to include things like the homeless, people using services that are not orthodox to the system, people that are unreachable by the system on the streets. Those are things that consumers can do and places that consumers can go that staff of the community mental health clinics, as bad as they might want to leave their desk, can't get out to and can't do outreach to.
5 minutes are up.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? Thank you. Betty Turner, Rick Snook, and Donita Diamata.
Hi, my name is Donita Diamata. I work in the mental health system in Portland, but more importantly to me, I am also a consumer of mental health services. I'm in absolute support of Senate Bill 771 because it strives to include the mental health consumer's voice in the system in a number of ways. First, by creating and supporting a consumer survivor advisory board, the state sends a clear and powerful message that the mental health consumer's voice does matter and it is important. Second, by supporting peer-delivered services and recognizing their benefits, the state further sends a message of the importance of the inclusion of consumers throughout the system, even as paid clinicians and advocates. By doing so, this minimizes polarization between system employees and the clients that they are paid to deliver services. It tends to have a more profound and positive impact on the lives of those receiving mental health services because basics such as camaraderie and bonds stemming from common experience are generally inherent when peers help fellow peers. Because so many of my personal experiences have reflected a feeling of no real voice in the direction of my own mental health services, or I have been completely dismissed as being an expert in my own life, I support this bill for the language it uses and the ideals it strives for. I'm done.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm Betty Nikoski Turner from Portland, Oregon, and I am a consumer of the mental health system, and I go to Cascadia and then by Albina and Killingsworth site. And I would like to see people who have mental health problems have a say in the decisions that are made about them. People who don't have mental illness may not be the best qualified to make decisions for us because they don't really know what we're going through or how we feel. And we are credible people and can do good things, and we should have a voice in what is going to be done about our lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Snook. I'm on the board of directors of Empowerment Initiatives. I was also responsible for opening up the first new brokerage in the developmental disability system in response to the Staley settlement. Empowerment Initiatives is the first consumer-operated mental health brokerage in the country. A year ago, I was on the third week of what ended up being a month-long psychiatric hospitalization. By the time I got out, my job was gone. Soon after that, I lost my home. I have struggled since then to keep my family and my head together, unable to afford medications that I require. Unemployed, I have fed my children with free food boxes from local charities. I know firsthand about the discrimination, misunderstanding, poverty, and mistreatment associated with being a person with a mental illness. I have had the privilege of being part of the initial development of self-directed supports in the state, from pilot programs to the implementation of a statewide brokerage system. I have seen the difference made by a simple but revolutionary concept. Now individuals with developmental disabilities have had the benefit of a successful lawsuit against the state that requires the provision of self-directed supports on a massive scale to all adults. This kind of luck has never come down the pike for individuals facing mental illness. In fact, Empowerment Initiatives is the first organization of its type in the nation. What we are doing is to point the way to a whole new vision in mental health services. People who experience mental illness are seen in a certain light by their community. It's not a flattering light. It's a mark of shame. We are held responsible by many for our illness. We are thought by others to have some kind of moral defect. Some people look at us and just say, quit acting crazy. We endure incredible prejudice, blatant discrimination, and stereotyping, even from those who have sympathy for us and even from those who are paid to provide us with supports. These supports are not just so minimal as to be absurd. They are delivered inevitably in a paternalistic manner that completely overlooks the individual's authority in their own life. The freedom and opportunity to choose our own road is something basic to the American ideal. The fact that we have had to struggle against the social service system and even against our own community to enjoy this freedom is a gross violation of that ideal. Traditionally and typically, the delivery of social services, whatever model, whatever facility or place, is a process that robs the individual of his or her basic self-respect. Anybody who has ever applied for food stamps to feed their family knows what I'm talking about. A person struggling in our society is systematically dehumanized. Their self-respect is ground down by the indignities they are forced to endure to get the most meager services and supports. If you tell me what I need and then give it to me, you reinforce my helplessness. At the same time, the services you intend to provide are compromised. If, on the other hand, you ask me respectfully instead of telling me, my answers will illuminate the supports that I require. More than that, I will retain my freedom and dignity. I've been on both sides of the system that treats and supports people with mental illness. It isn't working, but it's not just broken. It's underfunded to a horrific degree, but it is not just fiscally bankrupt. Its soldiers are burnt out, but it doesn't just need a heart transplant. It should have collapsed under the weight of its own stupidity years ago. Crazy doesn't even begin to describe it. There is an answer. It's not an easy answer, and it's a long way from where we are to where we need to be. Self-determination and social services, in this case, services for those of us with mental illness, is not just the latest fad. It's not just the model of the year. It is something really new, extremely simple, and like my teenage son, it cries out, duh. Ask people what they need before you give it to them. Simple. It's the only way you can help others in a respectful manner. The only way. It is a manifestation of basic respect for the humanity in each of us. It throws pies in the face of every bureaucracy it touches. People who have mental illness are just like you and just like me. We all deserve an opportunity to make choices and decisions that are important in our lives. We all deserve the dignity of defining our own success. Finally, we need to be embraced by our community and not shunned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
yes,
you.
Senator Morissette.
We need a copy of that, please.
Yeah. yes, if you could give that...
chicken scratches on it. It's just...
If we could have a copy of that, she'll make copies for us then. Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator George.
Madam Chair, that was a home run with the bases loaded. Can I clap?
Yes. Okay, any other comments? All right. Thank you very much. John Haynes, Ona Palmer, and Cappy.
See, I would.
John, do you want to go first?
I'll let Ona go first.
Okay, Ona can go first.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Ona Palmer. I'm a mental health consumer from Portland, Oregon. I received my mental health services from Cascadia, where I helped to get consumer counsel going at the site where I get my services. Before we got the council started back in September of 2004, all decisions were made by the staff and weren't listening to us. Now they are beginning to listen to us. We are starting to become a part of their decision making. This is giving us hope that good decisions will be made that will benefit the client. By passing this bill, it will require consumers to be a part of the mental health system at all levels of decision making. Also, by passing this bill, you will be supporting more consumers-delivered services. This is very important because mental health consumers now know more what other mental health consumers need and want. So often, what I call normies think they know what we need, and they don't. Consumers, where people like me are coming, know where people like myself know where we're coming from. Normies usually don't. How can they understand they don't experience the mental health illnesses that I do and issues on a daily basis?
Thank you.
Mine was a different type of life.
Introduce yourself.
My name is John Haynes. I lived in different situations as far as housing, but mostly on the southwest hills of Portland, Oregon. I could say I lived, but I was a runaway kid. What happened was is that in all different places, I didn't know family. I didn't know family to my mother, my father, and my two brothers. The situation is that I had some trouble as far as with people wanting me to know the capital of Oregon. And for some reason, I just couldn't say Salem. Salem is sort of a place I never visited as far as at that particular time. And I say that I squandered my education as far as all the way through with special ed. They give words such as retarded. There are worse things than being retarded. It's rubber. It's retread. And often you find them on the side of the road up in the hills of Mount Hood. Situation is that I was found as far as in different places and brought into the hospital system. I lost out because of alcoholism and video game addiction. Situation is that my losses are things that I find my mother and my father and my brother in another state, and I know geography. And traveling, there are particular road maps with the signs of saying where to go off. There are a lot of truth in areas where I'm looking for the word tourist traps. That can even be as far as into a person's heart. If a person doesn't want to see you, won't meet you as far as at the road situation or the state, just plain won't see you. There are a lot of closed houses, a lot of different people that tried to benefit, tried to love, tried to care. But it all comes down to, we need more than just a copay going down to nothing. We need, as far as a functioning Oregon plan for medical. We can't, as far as the President of the United States, I fear for him, as far as to some degree, with his decisions. because there are younger people that he's talking about putting Social Security money into what I consider gambling.
You have about a minute left.
What should I say in a minute?
Thank you.
Anyway, I'm just saying is that I'll say there were places that have never settled. The house up on my Council Crest Drive, City Hall in Portland, which I've spoken, Salem, which I've spoken today, and the White House. There's another joke. And it's bitter. One person asked me, actually two different places, how would I like to see a Democrat in the White House? I said, I've never been to the White House. So it's up to you as far as what you want in government. Stop playing around. Get to work.
All right, we will. Thank you. Ms. Eaton.
Chairman Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I also carry the mental health portfolio, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the League in support of Senate Bill 7771, particularly with the amendments that you have before you. The League has been concerned about and supportive of the efforts to enhance consumer voices and activities in the mental health and addiction services system for more than 20 years. At the national level, the League of Women Voters endorses a social policy which secures equal rights and equal opportunity for all and promotes social and economic justice and health and safety of all Americans. And at the Oregon level, our League members have discussed adult mental health issues and have agreed to support a comprehensive and integrated adult mental health system and delivery system which provides for coordination of local and state mental health facilities, provides for coordination of local and state mental health planning, ensures a continuity of care and humaneness, and provides a concept of care, treatment, and support in the least restrictive environment possible. Now, why do I talk about these things as an interested citizen? It's because for the last 40 years, I've been involved with mental health administrators, but more importantly with families and consumers and providers in looking at the system in Oregon. I've been part of the Oregon Mental Health Planning and Management Council, but particularly the Systems Change Grant, a steering committee of which Betty Childs spoke. We've had this grant now for the last 4 years, and as she pointed out, this was the lead grant for the United States, and its idea and purpose was to bring about systems change. And it's out of that committee and the discussion with consumers that this bill has come before you, because we felt that their voices are so important and we want to give them a larger voice in the coordination and the administration and evaluation of the programs and services which affect them. This is a self-determination bill. And it has come because we believe that the legislature can now put in place, with the cooperation of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, the kind of program that will hear the voices of consumers and give them a chance to really participate in the planning and the activities for which they need. We commend the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services for being willing to assist in this effort with oversight, cooperation, and staffing. The League urges the committee to support Senate Bill 771 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Senator Morissette.
Kathy, I will describe you as a normie with an attitude. How's that?
Thank you, Senator Morissette. I appreciate that.
Okay.
My husband says if I were any more committed, I would be.
Tammy Wehner, Crusita White, and Bob Junde.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, and especially Senator George. I've seen your openness. I've been watching and your receptiveness. And I appreciate it. I ask that all of you would just open your minds and hear us as consumers who are able to be strong advocates to empower.
And could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Tammy Wehner. Oftentimes, case managers in the mental health system carry a huge caseload, and we are the only population that has open degradation, disdain, and discrimination. Young mothers of young kids say, "Watch out! There goes someone that has mental illness," and you know, for the mental health. People who are really committed to wellness, which every person that I know that's in the mental health field, if they have the chance, wants to be well. And we have the opportunity as consumers, as peers, to say we know what you are going through, and we want to help you become well, and here's how we do it. And if you give us that opportunity, if you give us that chance, if you pass this, then what you're doing is you're allowing us to contribute greatly to society and greatly to us, and that's what we ask for. Thank you.
You can clap. All right.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Christina White, and I am a consumer of mental illness. My mother is a consumer. My daughter and my grandson is also. I'm new to the consumer issues, and I'm very pleased to be a part of putting the legislative bill, Senate Bill 771, together. I think it's... And I'm very active in the community. I grew up in Kaiser in the 60s, so my family's been here since 1956. I moved to Portland, and there are still so many hurting people there that I see as well as here. I'm a community advocate. I have been for years. I'm very interested in the voice, so that as I've heard many people testify, and I've experienced as well in different areas, employment, I have a barrier. Also with getting services as far as health, to receive my medication and counseling, and medical issues that I have as well. I have been fighting for my vocational rehab services, and as you've heard testimony, up to this point it has been that people in these positions tell you what you want or need, and that's not always true. And so I go round and round with these people and say no, and they say yes, and so it's very frustrating, and it does put a damper on your self-esteem and your contribution to the city, the communities, the state. So I'm very pleased that you are very interested, and hope that you will pass this bill to help all of us receive services and be able to contribute to the community. And as a person, as families, I'm very interested in impacting the populations that now are not receiving services for various reasons. As I said, my mother comes from that generation of shame, and I was raised under consumer issues and did not know what the problem was. So consequently, not only did I get consumer issues, but also being raised under one, it added additional issues. So I just would like to see family units receiving services, you know, whether it's the seniors and breaking the stigma, receiving wellness, and the populations that are hard to reach, as I know, as a minority. It requires trust. It requires sincerity. And it requires knowledge. I'm a big supporter of education. Once we learn what the system is and what's required and the reasoning, then we can go on and support each other when times. And so I just ask that you pass the bill to help the whole community. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Zanderson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Chundeth. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center. The Advocacy Center supports Senate Bill 771. The point I'd like to make today is that this isn't such a new idea. Back when our program to serve folks with mental illness was founded back in 86, the federal government told us that we needed to have a consumer advisory council, and we've had one now for almost 20 years. It's been an invaluable part of our operation. I wanted to evoke a couple names. One is Jerry Wang, who's an individual and a consumer who started an organization called the Mind Empowered, which is one of the first consumer-run service organizations in Oregon. I had the good fortune to be a founding board member of that organization, and it was an inspiration for me, and did a wonderful job in Portland. I'd also like to evoke the name of Garrett Smith, who was also a director of the Mind Empowered and moved on to work for the Office of Mental Health Services and provide invaluable service to them and to the consumers in Oregon, being the consumer voice in their office. It's a voice since Garrett left that hasn't truly been replaced, and I think that this particular council that's contemplated in 771 will do that, and we're looking forward to that becoming a reality.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Ryan Hammett, Pat Risser, and David Rampre. Ryan, do you want to go first?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello. My name is Ryan Hammett, and I'm a consumer of the mental health system in Portland. It is my hope that the promotion of self-determination for persons receiving mental health and addiction services will become policy. This is a provision of the bill HB 3108 and needs to be adopted by the SB 771. We have the opportunity to influence epic change today, and we can be a part of it.
Thank you very much.
My name is David Rompre, and Madam Chairwoman Anderson and all else duly distinguished and honored in front of me and in back of me, beside me, I would like to say, first of all, that I am bringing, as well as myself, I'm bringing the full endorsement of the group Mind Freedom, based in Oregon, who has asked me, their director has asked me to support the bill. That is, Mind Freedom is a consumer-operated advocacy group that is statewide and also has a lot of activity nationally as well. When I was growing up in Denver, Colorado, my track coach would get us in the back of his truck and take us to Ruby Hill, where we would do charges up it on as a workout. And on the way, we would pass Fort Logan Mental Health Center. My friend Pat is from this area. And we would yell out insults to people that we could see. And little did I know that in the 1980s, I would be seen to the public eye by people walking their dogs and playing frisbees and softball on the Oregon State Hospital grounds. I didn't know that I would inherit the family disease as well. But I did, but I was very fortunate to have encountered great recovery-oriented peer groups that encouraged me, people who really understood. And real quickly, I'd like to just draw your attention to something from the report, Achieving the Promise, Transforming Mental Health in America, which was put out by the President's new Commission on Mental Health, from the final report, July 2003. They write that the transformation of the mental health system should rest on two principles. First, services and treatment must be consumer and family-centered, geared to give consumers real and meaningful choices about treatment options and providers, not oriented to the requirements of bureaucracies. Second, care must focus on increasing consumers' ability to successfully cope with life's challenges, on facilitating recovery, on building resilience, not just on managing systems. symptoms. If you look at Senate Bill 771, Section 3, Part D, it says that the Office of Consumer Affairs will, quote, monitor the delivery of peer services and peer credentialed services and evaluate the impact, relevance, and efficiency of the delivery of evidence-based services in peer delivery settings. So, you know, we need a new expression for rocket science. It's not rocket science. But the deal is here, it's customer feedback. So what this does is it puts within the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services a compass and a barometer of how things are working and where things can go, so that our taxpayer money will do more work quicker, and the money won't have to be going out, the preponderance of it, putting out the psychiatric fires of lives that are not allowed hope.
Thank you.
My name is Pat Risser from West Lynn, Oregon. I'm one of six consumer survivors on the Federal Subcommittee on Consumer Survivor Issues, supported by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and the Center on Mental Health Services. I'm one of six consumer survivor voices to the highest federal mental health authority. But you still don't know anything about me. That's because I'm going to get there. One of my favorite, you know, I consider myself an advocate activist. I'm not a consumer because I no longer use mental health services. Instead, I give back. I consider myself an advocate activist. And what that means is, if you had 100 people in a state hospital and somehow you managed to get 50 of them out and placed in the community, I'd join in the celebration with you, but I'd also be knocking on your door the next day saying, what about number 51? Until you get all 100 out. Because I consider that my role in the system. That's part of my job, part of my voice. And I think sometimes my role and my voice gets a little passionate and a little heated and a little excited. And I think maybe sometimes Bob Nickel cringes when he sees me coming because he's sure, oh, God, what did I do now? You know, but I got to tell you, I'm here to tell you what he's doing right. And what he's doing right today is supporting this and supporting us having our own voice. Now, why is it important that we have our own voice? I mean, why can't other people speak for us? There are people out there who contend that they're the experts, right? There are people, academicians, who do research, who think they have the answers. I got to tell you that as a child growing up, I was tortured, beaten, hurt severely by my mother. My stepfather raped me repeatedly at night from the age of 7 to 17. And being the good, staunch soldier that I am, growing up in this society, I put those memories aside. I wiped them out until at some point in my adulthood, I couldn't keep them from coming back. You may not know it, but 80% or more of all people in the mental health system are survivors of some sort of trauma, abuse, or neglect. What's that got to do with anything? When I went to the mental health system and asked for help, and I started to get passionate and excited and cried or laughed too hard or anything, expressed my hurt, my pain, you know what the answer was? You're expressing too much. We'll put you in seclusion and restraint, where you will relive that feeling of hopelessness, helplessness that you felt being raped by your stepfather. A couple of years ago, I sat on a state committee talking about seclusion and restraints in this state. And I was the only one in the room who had ever been in the eternity that is seclusion or restraints. It's important that we have our own voice. Not just to remember. I no longer use mental health services, but you should know, I was hospitalized over 20 times, including state hospital. I was unemployed. I was homeless, living on the streets. I've been there, done that. And now you're looking at a homeowner, a taxpayer, somebody who gives back. What happened? I can tell you what happened. I know what works. That's why our voice is so important. Recovery can and does happen for people But if you want to know how it happens, ask those of us who have recovered. Academicians buried in their books, you know, are going to give you cold facts and figures. But if you want to know about people, talk to us. You've heard a lot of people talk today about peer services. We are the peers. We've been there. And we know how to help others. Bob Nickel is doing a really great thing. Even without the support of this, he said, I've got to have a consumer council. I've got to have the voices of those people telling me what's right and what isn't. Even if it's painful to listen to, I've got to hear the advocates and the activists and the people who've been there and who have recovered and are working and struggling with recovery. I need to hear those people and not just the professionals, experts who... Wait a minute. Now, how many people have they helped over the last 20 years? Wait, it seems like a lot of people are still doing the same things. But you know what? The system's starting to get better now that we're being listened to. This is real important. I strongly urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay. I had planned to move it, and then I found out that it had a fiscal, and it would have to go to Ways and Means. And I really, really want to have this heard on the floor. I think that's part of the process, and we'll see. We may not be able to, but I'll be bringing it back next Tuesday for a work session, one way or another. We'll be getting it out of committee for sure. It's just we're not sure which direction it's going to go. Anyway, thank you very much for coming. This is an extremely important issue to me and I think to the members of the committee. Any comments? All right. I'll close the public hearing on 771 and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 704 and have Senator Cruz and Senator Ferrioli and Representative Gary Hansen. Do you want to go down or?
No.
Okay, there's
Gary. Let me briefly describe this.
Okay. Mr. Bacobian, will you briefly describe what the bill says?
Thank you, Senator. It's a fairly short bill. Prohibits the Department of Human Services and Department of Corrections from limiting medication choices for mental health drugs to persons in state hospital. Under background, there's a misprint there. This includes state hospital, both Salem and Portland campuses, as well as the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, and then all Department of Corrections systems. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Senator Cruz and Senator Representative Hansen, we'll start out with you two.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Hansen. I'm State Representative from House District 44. This bill is, as you can tell, very short, very to the point. We want to ensure that patients receive the best medications for their particular condition when they come into state custody. And that's the extent of it.
Yeah. Wow. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Cruz, State Senator, District 1. That's the shortest speech I've ever heard Representative Hansen make. I'm impressed. But it's
Senator Ferrioli, do you want to join them?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll wait for a moment.
Okay.
I like this bill for a couple reasons. Number one, it's really short, and it's direct and to the point, the real issue here is, as we all know, we have a lot of people in our corrections system that have mental health problems. A lot of people. And as we struggle to find appropriate settings for these people, they're still in the correction system. So wouldn't it make sense that they got appropriate mental health treatment where they are? That includes having appropriate mental health drug regimes and not just whatever is cheap or handy. And really that's what this is all about, is to make sure that the people that we have in our state system are getting the types of treatment they need. And it's not just drugs, it gets into the appropriate types of therapy too. But clearly, we shouldn't be warehousing these people just because they're in the corrections system. We should be trying to help them achieve a level of stability and a level of normalcy. And that's what this bill is designed to do, is just allow people that are in the state system to get appropriate care wherever they happen to be. It's a very simple bill. I think it's very timely when you look at the other mental health issues we're working through. And there are other states that are doing this and doing it very effectively. And ultimately we get to disease management here, but having the flexibility is what's needed to make that happen. And so I urge passage of this bill. I understand there maybe an amendment. I'm not sure what that looks like. I'm not sure I'm excited about it, but this is a very simple bill, and this so dovetails into what testimony we just heard about making sure that people are getting appropriate treatment wherever they are. And I'm really very, very excited, very happy to join Senator Carter and Representative Hansen at this dais. And thank you, Senator Carter, for bringing forward this bill.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee. And excuse me, thank you very much. My name is Margaret Carter, State Senator from North Northeast Portland, District 22. I thank Senator Cruz and Representative Hansen for joining me here today. Senate Bill 704 ensures that patients in the Oregon State Hospital and incarcerated in our state correctional facilities have access to the specific mental health medications prescribed by his or her mental health provider. I just wanted to read that point. I'm running between committees.
Thank you.
Excuse me. I think it's so vital, Madam Chair, members of the committee, because when people come from the outside into the correction system, if they have been given a particular medication, and then to bring them into the system and all of a sudden change that medication, it could potentially be dangerous for the patient because there's no follow-through and there's no consistency. And it would appear to me that of all the information that we have received, all the data that we have read about in terms of making sure that people with mental health issues have consistency in medication, or we'll suffer another Seattle where the person was on some old therapy and there was a disaster on the highway where he was shooting at people because he was not using his medication, and then some of the old therapies were not working. And so what I want to see have happen in this state is there's some consistency when a person comes from the outside and a particular medication has been recommended for them, that we follow through with that in the prison system as opposed to using the one size fit all. And I think that that's very dangerous. And especially when you look at studies have been done on ethnic minorities, that one size does not fit all and has not worked very well. So, you know, I'd hate to be a person that would going into the prison system and all of a sudden you want me to take one drug that everybody else takes. Now, yes, it does save the state money. It does that. But no, it doesn't help the individual patients that are coming in. And so what this bill is designed to do is to have the corrections department respect the fact that when individuals come in, haven't had a particular therapy recommended for them, that that therapy is followed through on. And that's a nutshell of this bill. And I wish that in your deliberation that you will act favorably in passing this bill out. Now, I know other people are coming behind me that saying that there is a ways and means piece to it, but Madam Chair, if you have to, I would appreciate very much your sending it down to Ways and Means so we can take a good look at it.
Thank you. What happens actually now if someone has a specific regimen, medication regimen, and what happens now? Are they put on a different type
whatever
drug?
That's the drug is, or if we buy in bulk, that's what they get.
Okay.
You know, Madam Chair, if I could, just a couple more comments. You know, a lot of people with mental health problems, we kind of roll the dice as to what medication is appropriate. And Senator Carter's right. In cases of the state system, it's what we can buy cheapest in a lot of cases. But when, you know, and they will say that this could potentially cost money. But let's look long term at the fact that if we can get them into a good therapy regimen while they're still incarcerated, when they transition back out into the community and they've already got a program that works for them, their chances of recidivism decrease and their chances of success in the outside world become greater. So there is an incredible long-term benefit to this.
And Madam Chair, we're not asking for specialized care. We're asking that the prison system, the prison administrators treat this as a Medicaid, as people who are on Medicaid received outside of the prison wall. And so even if they are since these people will be considered low-income people and they don't have access to mental health, it would appear to me that they would fall under the aegis of the guidelines of that. And so the Department of Human Services does not restrict access to mental health medication for the state's Medicaid patients, and you did that in Senate Bill 819, and this was championed by Governor Kitzhaber. And so I'm saying, why do we treat people on Medicaid outside of the system and treat them so different inside of the system? That's an act of discrimination as far as I'm concerned. It might be the word might be used a little hard, but I mean it that way. And so some consistency and some respect for the mentally ill, whether they're inside or whether they're out, should be consistent.
Okay. Senator Farioli, would you like to, that you're the last of the members, bring forth your testimony?
Let me just say thank you very much, and I've got to go back to committee.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, normally I have to pick up a guitar to clear a room that fast. Ted Farioli, representing District 30, and here also representing Senator Winters. And members of the committee, I hope you'll treat me like the student pilot that runs out of airspeed, altitude, and experience all at the same time. I'm well out of my depth on this issue. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I will read a brief statement that Senator Winters asked me to read before the committee today.
Thank you.
Dear Chair Monis Anderson, I regret that I'm unable to appear in person this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 704. I consider this bill a very important extension of the continued promise we have made to ensure that the state does not interfere with a prescriber's ability to obtain mental health medications for those in the state's care. As a body, we specifically exempted mental health medications from the preferred drug list created by Senate Bill 819 in 2001. Last session, House Bill 3624 guaranteed that all Medicaid clients, whether fee-for-service or managed care, would be able to obtain the actual medicines prescribed for treatment of their mental health conditions. I had the honor of carrying House Bill 3624 in the Senate. I am pleased to note that the bill passed both chambers unanimously. Senate Bill 704 is the critical next step. The protections we have already passed do not apply to those in state hospital, nor to those in state prisons. Passage of Senate Bill 704 will bridge the gap for these vulnerable populations and strengthen the promise we've made. We must ensure medical professionals are able to use their best medical judgment to determine the most appropriate medicine to treat mental illness. Thank you for your consideration of this important bill. I urge your support and look forward to the Senate deliberations of the measure. Sincerely, Senator Jackie Winters.
Comments?
Let's ask him a lot of technical questions.
Well, if Matt Jackie's
Chairman,
watching,
ask away. I'll defer to Senator Winters, who may be watching. And
that's right.
and who certainly could answer your questions were she here today.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee.
Jeffrey Davis and Angela Kimball. Oh, and Dr. Teresa Shelby, too. Those are the last of the neutrals.
Madam Chair, committee members, I am Jeff Davis, and I'm here representing Oregon Partners in Crisis. This is a group that was formed about 1 year ago, consisting of county commissioners, sheriffs, judges, district attorneys, defense attorneys, advocates, consumers, and mental health providers. This group is really looking at and trying to promote statewide improved collaboration between mental health in the criminal justice system, partly because all of the members that are there are realizing that jails and penitentiaries are becoming default mental health institutions today. There are two issues that partners would like to have you consider when you're deliberating on this bill. The first one is that cost should not be the sole factor in making decisions. If you look at what the legislature passed last session, you put a lot of emphasis on evidence-based practice or best practices. Cost isn't necessarily correlated with what's the best type of care to provide to somebody who has mental illness. So when you're looking at this, keep in mind that there could be medications that in fact might be more costly, but in fact in the long run might be more effective. The second piece is that we're always concerned, and you hear a lot about it today already, consistency and coordination of care. And one of the issues that was identified pretty strongly in a federal report titled The Report of Reentry Policy Council, looking at the reentry of people with mental illnesses coming from the penitentiary back into the community, one of the big concerns in that report was really not coordinated and consistent care between being an institution and being in the community. People that go into to the state hospital or into the state penitentiary go off Medicaid, probably lose their insurance. They may have had medication before they went in. They may have a different medication when they get in. They may get a different medication when we get out. We know in the recovery model, consistent care, which includes medication, is very important for recovery. So I think the two issues the partners would like to leave with you, cost shouldn't be the sole driver, and we're really concerned about having better and more consistent care between the institutions and the community to truly establish recovery, which everybody wants, and you heard wonderful stories about it this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'd just like to share that the community mental health programs actually share the concern of the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services regarding the need to manage soaring prescription costs. Like the state, we struggle to balance access to care, which can be extended, frankly, to more people when we effectively manage scarce resources. But at the same time, we have an overriding concern with quality of care. In fact, in trying to balance those two different concerns, we've been working very closely with Dr. Pollack at the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services regarding a best prescribing practices model that has resulted in cost savings and is consistent with our goal of providing quality and continuity of care through managing prescribing rather than through restricting access to medications. And since, unfortunately, far too many individuals with serious mental illness end up in jails and in our prison, our deepest concern, our hope, actually, is that the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services actually work together to promote continuity of the most effective care for individuals with serious mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Teresa Shelby. I'm a child psychiatrist in Beaverton, and today I'm speaking for the Oregon Psychiatric Association. First, I'd like to point out, when I was looking at this bill with a group of other psychiatrists recently, it was pointed out that there might be some ambiguity in the language, that it could be construed as meaning that the person in the state institution could choose any mental health drug they wished. Just for your consideration, we suggested that it should be clear that the medication choices not be limited for the prescribing health professional treating the person in the state institution. But what this is essentially about is preventing the establishment of a restricted or limited formulary of drugs used to treat mental illness. And from the previous speakers, it sounds like that is what is happening in some locations currently. As far as I'm aware, the reasons for this would be cost and possibly issues having to do with inventory and storage. Psychiatrists are very well aware that the costs of psychotropic drugs are very considerable and increasing, and it's a very significant problem in correctional settings. But I feel it's important to point out that there are some particular factors with psychotropic drugs that make restrictive formularies penny-wise, pound-foolish. Psychotropic drugs are not interchangeable. If a patient is stabilized on drug X, it is very perilous to change to drug Y, even if it's a closely related drug in the same class. There's a great deal of variability in how patients respond to mental health drugs. For example, there's six what we call SRI antidepressants, as Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, etc. When each of these drugs has been tested on large groups of appropriate people, they're all effective the great majority of the time. But for reasons that we really don't entirely understand, for an individual patient, very often we will find that one or two or three work for that patient and others don't. Or perhaps the patient has intolerable side effects on some of the medications but does very well with others. So sometimes the process of stabilizing a patient requires kind of a series of medications for comparison to find the best drug. Three out of those six drugs in that class are generic, and we generally have no opposition to the concept of using generic drugs whenever possible when that is working for the patient. But many times we need broader choices. In a correction setting, having the patient on the right medication might make the difference between them being in the normal population versus being in the special management unit on suicide watch. So we think that having the right medication saves money even within the institution. And when it comes to the state hospital, having the patient well stabilized might mean that patient is discharged sooner, thus saving a lot of money. There are many situations where the cheapest drug is not the best for the situation. One place I work is a drug and alcohol treatment for adolescents who are in the custody of Oregon Youth Authority. About 50% of these youths are methamphetamine addicted. Some of them also have attention deficit disorder, which needs to be treated while they're in this program. Otherwise, they can't settle down and participate and benefit from the program. The cheapest way to treat attention deficit disorder is probably a generic form of Ritalin. But for these methamphetamine-addicted youths, unfortunately, I've learned through bitter experience, if I even have any Ritalin or anything in that class in the building, it gets misappropriated and ground up and used as a drug of abuse. So I need to treat their attention deficit disorder with a different kind of medication that is not abusable, but it is more expensive.
You have about a minute. Can you sum up?
Finish. We believe there are rational and clinically sound ways that administrators and prescribers can partner to keep medication costs lower. generic drugs when possible, avoiding polypharmacy, that's multiple drugs, educating prescribers about costs and alternatives. And we are used to the concept of preferred drugs, especially if the preferred drugs are preferred not only for cost but also for safety and efficacy. But there always needs to be a clinical override that that exceptions can be made so individual patients can get the medications they need. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes,
Chair.
Senator Morissette.
In reading this bill very, very carefully, there's three lines to it. How does this limit your choice? I don't. It says may not limit medication choice.
Well, I'm primarily in support of the bill.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Okay.
We're saying it's also okay with us to encourage, you know, the lowest cost options, not just a blank check.
Okay. That comes under the general idea of no limiting.
Yes, no absolute limiting.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I really didn't hear anything from this panel that's really in opposition to it. And as I read the bill, I don't think the language of the bill puts the person in charge of their drugs at all. So I think the language is relatively clear. It says choices for mental health drugs for persons in state institutions, not by. So I think the language is probably okay the way it is. And I mean, quite simply, all this bill is trying to do is, I mean, we have said for two sessions in a row now that we should not limit access to mental health drugs, and this is a population we haven't done that for.
Okay, thank you. We have three more people, David Pollack, Arthur Tolan, and Dr. Mary McCarthy, and if you could limit your comments 3 minutes, that would be wonderful, because we have two other bills besides this one.
Good observation.
Three other bills. Okay, we'll have to carry them over. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm David Pollack. I'm the medical director for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I've also had the privilege of coming before this committee to describe the medication initiatives that Angela Kimball was referring to in the last panel. And it may seem odd that I'm stating that the department's position at the present time is opposed to this bill. It has more to do with the fact that the bill is actually so short and that it may be subject to misinterpretation or confusion when it comes to trying to implement it or develop administrative rules associated with it. And therefore, we remain open to discussing how it might be modified to improve and clarify some of the concerns that we currently have in relation to it. The Department of Human Services, through the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, is responsible for the management of the two state hospitals, Oregon State Hospital with its two campuses in Portland and Salem, and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. And those hospitals are controlled in some ways by standards that are imposed by the accrediting organizations, the JCAHO, which is the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And both of those organizations have standards that require having pharmaceutical and therapeutics committees that have to use various criteria in selecting what medications go on or off of a hospital formulary. All hospitals have formularies. These factors in making those choices include the clinical indications, the appropriateness of the medication, side effects, and so forth, but they also include cost and other factors. It is important that we not set ourselves up with something that could be putting the hospitals at risk, and I would imagine my colleague from DOC is going to say the same thing in terms of the Department of Corrections facilities. We think that there are a better approach is we think that what we've been doing throughout the state in terms of promoting the idea of looking at practice patterns and educating prescribing providers, and doing that in hospitals sometimes is done through the management, through a pharmaceutical and therapeutics committee that includes a significant representation of the medical staff. In fact, the pharmacy and therapeutics committees answer to the medical staff in the state hospital. So when they come up with their ideas of what medications are appropriate to use for certain conditions, that's really important that it is medically driven. The other aspect of this in relation to the hospitals is that the quality of care, we're concerned that there could be a risk that the bill itself could undermine quality of care the way it is currently written, in that it may make the door wide open and some prescribing providers could choose medications that were inappropriate for patients, and therefore the consequence could be that they would have longer stays in these very expensive facilities. We think a more rational approach, especially one that is more systematically administered and encouraged throughout our hospitals and other facilities as we're trying to do in our outpatient system, makes more sense. This is consistent with Senate Bill 267, the evidence-based practice initiative that we're trying to adhere to, and our concern is that this bill, the way it's currently written, might undermine or interfere with our ability to say we are using evidence-based practices in the administration of medications in our state hospitals. There is potentially some fiscal impact from this bill, depending on how it's interpreted. We see that it could be somewhere in the range of several hundreds of thousands of dollars in a year, depending on how we were able to manage medications, making sure that people got the right medications. This is not in contradiction to what Senators Carter and the others in the first panel said, but to say that we want to make sure that the right medications are going to persons and that that's being overseen in a way that there's a quality management aspect to it. So although we think there was very good intention, which we agree with in terms of the drafting of the bill, we think there are problems with the way it is, primarily because it is so brief and open to interpretation in regard to some of the accreditation issues, the quality management issues, and issues that relate to costs. And we'd be very delighted to have the opportunity to discuss it further outside of this session.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Now, are you familiar with the Missouri program?
I certainly am, Senator Cruz and Chair Anderson. I am actually running our project that is modeled after and is parallel to the Missouri program, and we are doing that program very effectively. But that is one of several instruments, if you will, or approaches that we think make sense in terms of managing medication and reducing cost, maintaining access, and maintaining quality. We're also approaching this through the area of looking at dose consolidation and the area of practice guidelines. And the practice guideline approach, we're trying to implement something that would be like that which has been done in Texas and which the Missouri program actually is related to in its rationale. Mm-hmm. And the implementation of practice guidelines might be contrary to the language or the intent or what would be interpreted as the intent of this bill, and we have that concern as well.
Okay, Madam Chair, I guess Senator Morissette and I were sitting there talking about how simple this bill is, and yet it seems like the shorter and simpler it is, the more complicated it becomes, which is somewhat counterintuitive. I mean, certainly the Missouri-Texas approach is the direction we need to be going, and we don't want to stand in the way of that. I don't see this bill doing that, so I'd be interested in seeing the language you think that may be a problem there.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Yeah. I guess we're focusing on the word may not limit. Doesn't say shall not, doesn't say shall limit, may not. Is that a permissive word?
We had that debate a couple seconds ago.
I know. So maybe it does need some further explanation if we're talking, the one word may can have multiple meanings, I guess. So I hadn't thought of that, and maybe that's the problem.
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Morissette, I will defer to you all. I'm just a lowly bureaucrat.
I'm not buying that one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Tolan, and I'm the administrator for counseling and treatment services for the Department of Corrections. I am here to provide some information in opposition of this bill as it is written, and my colleague Dr. Pollack explained very eloquently why is that. And also, I would like to address a little bit the issue of the persons with mental illnesses in the Department of Corrections. As you have heard from previous presentations that we have done in front of various committees, roughly about 14% of all individuals coming to the Department of Corrections suffer from a serious to a severe mental illness. Our number one responsibility when in dealing with these individuals is to stabilize them, and our approach strategy is to provide treatment in the least restrictive environment, which would be our general population rather than specialized housing units. So each person coming to prison is assessed for the existence of a mental illness, and then an individualized treatment plan is developed. And I think that what we're talking about here is more than just a formulary, but we talk about treatment guidelines which look at various methods of treating an individual, from programs, individual counseling, what housing unit, as well as medication. So to do that, we use treatment guidelines, which are based on best practices that guide us not only the most effective means of treating these individuals, but also the most efficient. And if you look at from that perspective, this bill doesn't do anything to improve patient care, but also it will increase the cost. And I will explain that a little bit later. At the same time, we must be effective stewards of public resources, and our psychiatrists, our prescribers, every time they are dealing with an individual that suffers from a mental illness, they use their experience, they use best practices, evidence, research, and they use what is best for that individual when make a determination what medication to prescribe. Sometimes you may deal with two medications that have the same effectiveness at same side effect profile. In that case, one is cheaper, less expensive, the other one is more expensive. Then the practice would be to prescribe the medication that is less expensive. We anticipate this bill will have a significant impact, especially when we consider the fact that the Department of Corrections has a fixed budget. And if you look at prescribing medications that are just as effective, more expensive medications that are just as effective as the less expensive medications, you're looking at perhaps not treating other people that may need treatment, because now you used up your resources in providing these most costly medications. Our department's mental health staff also monitor the effectiveness of each inmate's treatment plan, including prescribed medications. And if a prescribed medication is not effective or not efficient, then that information is presented to the prescriber, and there is another medication that is an option for that individual. It was mentioned that every hospital has a formulary. The Department of Corrections has a semi-closed formulary, meaning that medications are available to the prescribers, but there is a first choice medication and a second choice medication. And if a prescriber wants to go outside the formulary and prescribe a medication that is probably the one that considers is the only one working, regardless of how expensive it is, that information is presented to the Pharmaceutics and Therapy Committee, and approval is sought through that body of professionals.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Sorry for interrupting. Do you see the word may as a command or an option?
Well,
no, really. I mean, because if it's an option, then you can do all of the things you're saying. If it's a command, then you can't. So maybe that's what I read into this bill. It's when I read may, to me, it's an option. Shall says you won't do it.
Oh, well.
I don't know. Maybe
I would like to defer to
no.
To you.
No.
Could you summarize?
Our mental health treatment guidelines are continuously reviewed and they take into consideration state-of-the-art prescribing information, including new medications, new indications for older medications, safety, efficacy, changes in the relative cost-effectiveness of medication. The use of treatment guidelines, evidence-based practices, and cost-effective treatments are all in the best interest of excellent patient care, and it is our belief that this bill will interfere with our ability to use these tools. For these reasons, we would respectfully ask you to reject the bill as it is, and as my colleague mentioned, we would be open to sit down and talk about maybe additional language to this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we hear the last, we're not going to get to 876 and 877. That will be scheduled for next Monday. All right? So you can put that in. Yes.
I guess I'm confused. You say there could be a fiscal impact here, and yet you're saying that through your process, you get the people to the appropriate medications for them, which is what this bill is designed to do. So if you're getting them to the appropriate medications, how can there be a fiscal impact here?
Can I try to answer? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, let me give you a couple explicit examples.
Okay.
This may not have to do with formulary so much, but the notion of limiting choice or appearing to limit choice. If a prescribing provider chooses a certain medication that has several forms, and there are a couple of the antipsychotic medications like risperidone that has an oral form that's in pills and an injectable form that lasts longer. The injectable form is substantially more expensive than the pill form. There are two forms of another antipsychotic medication. One is a regular pill, and another is a tablet that dissolves under the tongue for patients who appear to not be as reliable in keeping their medication, or sometimes they choose not to take it, and in those settings, it's often felt that those people should be on those medications. However, it appears that sometimes prescribing providers out of habit may prescribe the more expensive form of one or both of those medications for some patients when the patient might be very easily managed with the less expensive form of it. The bill as it stands might prevent the system, the facility for managing and making those choices to choose the less expensive of those two forms of the same medication. And that could represent substantial fiscal impact.
Okay, I guess I can see that. That's a potential there, but either way, they're getting the same medication. It's just the form. I'm not sure, but you know, that's something to look at language for, I guess. So,
Chair and Montes Anderson and Senator Cruz, that's part of the reason we are concerned about the ambiguities of the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Dr. Shelby. Is that you?
No, it's McCarthy, but that's okay.
There you are, Dr. McCarthy.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mary McCarthy. I'm an adult psychiatrist from Portland, but I also do, I have a private practice there, and I also do some part-time consulting with the Department of Corrections, so I have some knowledge about what goes on in that system. And obviously the fiscal issues are very important, as we all know, and budget is just about everything, it seems like, no matter where you go or what you do these days. I don't think this bill is necessary because I think, at least in my experience from working for the Department of Corrections, we already are dealing and taking care of these issues, and that the bill isn't really necessary. And I agree with Dr. Pollack that sometimes when you have legislation, it's misinterpreted, or then, in my experience, sometimes there are lawsuits that come out of it to define what it exactly means. And I think we're already doing the best practices in the prison in terms of when a patient comes into the system, if they've come on medication that's not on our formulary, what we do is assess the situation, determine whether they have failed the formulary drugs in the past. If they have, then there's a process we go through to request a non-formulary medication. Also, the antipsychotic medications are not restricted in the Department of Corrections formulary. We have choice of any antipsychotic that we want without any kind of restriction. There are some restrictions on antidepressants, but even for those patients, if they've tried certain ones and failed, we document that, and then there's a process we go through, and the chief psychiatrist, Dr. Ruthven, who couldn't be here today, looks over that request, and almost always it's approved. It's just a matter of filling out a paper. And I don't think this bill is necessary, at least for the Department of Corrections. And I also do some part-time consulting at the state hospital, although in a different role. And I don't see, from my knowledge of that system, that they're restricted either, as long as the doctors go through, you know, the procedures that the formulary department or system has set up. So I really think the bill's not necessary.
Even though
I agree with the, you know, the reasons behind it.
Senator George?
Well, pardon me for just being the old country farmer from Newburgh, Oregon, but if you're doing what this bill requires, how could there be any additional expense? A fiscal impact.
My concern, and I'm not an attorney, but my concern is that when you put something in wording as a bill, but then someone tries to challenge it. And I think this is maybe especially true in the Department of Corrections. A lot of these patients that I see there are very litigious. And so if they don't like what I'm doing and they want to, you know, file a lawsuit, that because of this bill, that may open it up to a lawsuit. But again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just telling you my personal opinion as a psychiatrist.
Yes. It was suggested earlier that we add in for prescribing professionals. Do you think that would help it?
Well, yeah, definitely. And what Dr. Shelby said, and I'm on the legislative committee of the Psychiatric Association with her, and we talked about inserting that. And I'm not against, you know, why they brought forth this bill. I'm in favor of the concept. My concern is that it may open Pandora's box.
All right.
I'll save mine for later.
All right. Okay, thank you very much.
You.
I'm going to close a public hearing on 704 and open a public hearing on 824. Senator Shields and Barney, Janine Smith and Barney Spate, you three are about the only ones we're going to have time for, and we will continue this. And we will then carry this one over to the following Monday, what we don't get done today.
What day is that?
Here. That would be April 4th. Senator Shields.
I'm going to listen to her for a minute if she wants to go.
Okay. Her. Do you want to describe it or let them introduce it? Okay.
Thank you. I think she's trying to go to PowerPoint.
I'm Dr. Janine Smith from the Office of Health Policy and Research, Deputy Administrator, and I wanted to briefly show you our research that our office has done in combination with the Medicaid agency and outside researchers. I'll try to hit just the highlights. You have the full presentation. It's from two studies. We looked at administrative data from Medicaid, looking at the impact on premiums, and we also did a survey of those who were enrolled at the plan prior to the waiver changes, and asked what was going on with them 6 months later. It was all grant money. Just to remind you what happened in February 2003, the Oregon Health Plan changed. And in regards to premiums, we've always had premiums since December of 1995, but we changed a little bit higher amounts in what we charged, and the policy around the premiums changed, where we no longer offered a waiver for zero incomes. And if you did not pay your premiums after a month, you were locked out, for not able to reapply for 6 months. In the past, you could catch up at the six-month re-enrollment for any past due payments. We also had significant budget cuts, which led to benefit cuts, and co-pays were introduced. And these are the reasons we were thinking when we wrote the waiver in that manner. We were trying to get some more money to expand coverage and encourage people to stay on the plan, because we have past studies that suggest that people fall off and only come on when they're sick, and also to make it look more like commercial. So we had impacts in three areas: access, enrollment, and utilization. When surveyed, the people people that had lost coverage reported a higher unmet need. This is particularly true for those with chronic illness, and worry about cost was their primary reason for this. And this graph shows those in the 0 to 10%, 57% of them feel cost is their biggest reason that they were no longer on the plan. And in the higher income levels, there was a 41%. And their impacts on enrollment. In the period that was studied, we saw a drop of 45%, and it was primarily in those in the lower income, zero income. And I think this graph captures that. The top line is, the red line is those between 0 and 10% of federal poverty level. And you can see the drop-off started about the time the changes started in March. The steepest part of that line is in April, when we implemented the policy of locking them out if they didn't pay their premiums. There was impacts, as I said, on the lowest income. Premium cost was what they said was the most common reason in our survey questions. And most who lose coverage remained uninsured. We did ask if they would be willing to pay, and if we lowered the cost a little, and we asked them, would, if we lowered it $3, would you? And almost 50% said they would. And then if you look at where they're, the largest percentage here have not found other health coverage. And this was at about 6 months after the changes. We have a second survey in the field, and we should have results in the next few weeks over where these people are today. And those who've lost coverage were three times more likely to have no usual source of care and more likely to have skipped a prescription. And this has direct impacts. If you think that a large percentage of these folks have chronic illness, they're more likely to use other areas of the healthcare system and 4 to 5 times more likely to go to the emergency room. And this is particularly true in that lowest income level. Just to remind you what's happened since, the mental health and chemical dependency outpatient benefits were reinstated, and the OHP standard, this adult population, is entirely funded by provider tax dollars. There's no general fund in this at the present time. But we had to freeze enrollment in order to keep within that budget box, and OHP standard will be down to $24,000 by the end of this biennium. And co-pays, which we were in, were eliminated based on our court ruling. So the research suggests that you would want to consider elimination of the premiums because we think this would maintain the enrollment among the poorest of the individuals. This is an extremely vulnerable group with a lot of chronic physical and mental illness and less likelihood of an impact in cost shifting to other areas of the healthcare system. And we also, because of that steep decline in that one graph, would particularly want to maybe a reassessment of this lockout policy, particularly in this low income, for some of the similar reasons that these are an extremely vulnerable group.
Thanks to the researchers.
Thank you.
Frank, I know that you've only got a couple of minutes.
Could I ask just this?
Yes.
No, we're talking about we aren't talking about categoricals here.
No,
at all.
No,
pay a premium.
No, Chairman, Vice Chair, Senator Cruz. No, this is an expansion adults who are only on the health plan because of their low income. They don't fit into a Medicaid category of care.
Well, I just want to make the point that the categoricals, there's no premium for them to begin with. So the majority of the health plan population doesn't pay a premium.
Quick comment from me. A picture that's stuck in my head. It's just
and introduce yourself.
Senator Frank Shields, District 24. Sorry about that. Yeah, come to think of it, I am sorry I'm Senator Shields. given the current context of what we're doing for all the poor in the community, a picture that I can't get out of my head. I visited a health clinic in Portland. This health clinic gave me amazing numbers of the number of people that they see and the price that they see them for. And they can actually take care of a patient for about $750 a year. I forget the exact amount of money. Budget cuts for some of the poorest of the poor have forced those people off the rolls, as was just elaborated on this slide. And then they said $750 a year, compare that to $1,100 per visit if they get sicker and sicker and sicker and end up in an emergency room. That picture won't go away, and I hope it doesn't go away from any of you. Just keep that in your mind. $750 a year, $1,100 per visit. How can you turn down this kind of deal? Your turn.
Okay, hold it. I just found out that there are two people that have come to testify on this bill, and they're not always in the building, John Duke and Christy Jameson. Would you defer to those two, and then we will consider this. You'll come back, Barney.
Available at almost all the time.
24/7, right?
He's disappointed.
A week from today, okay. So would the John Duke and Christy Jameson please come forward? And I appreciate your patience, and I wish I had known that earlier. I would have had you come up because we are minus 1 minute going and going. You want to start?
Hi, my name is Christy Jameson, and I work for a safety net provider in Portland. I support 824. Supporting the elimination of premiums for 0 to 10% of the FPL makes good sense for our state. I have worked with the recipients of Oregon Health Plan since 94. I have seen people overcome addiction, stabilize chronic health conditions, and resolve mental health issues due in large part to access to the care the Medicaid eligibility afforded them. Most were indigent, homeless, and unable to manage their health matters independently. As of February 2005, there are 29,999 adult recipients left on OHP standard, OHP 2. 13,667 of that number fall in the 0 to 10% category, and those are OMAP numbers. This represents the core group remaining on the plan. I feel that this group has absorbed the brunt of the OHP penalties enacted over premiums and other discriminatory policies. Currently, there is a premium sponsorship work group actively involved in raising funding to cover all premium levels led by Liz Baxter of Oregon Health Policy and Research. To date, the Hospital Association of Oregon has been sponsoring a $6 premium level statewide. This has helped stabilize the 0 to 10% premium group somewhat, although the commitment is month to month. I'm increasingly concerned about the limited recourse and options those disqualified from OHP have. As you know, the failure to pay premiums results in a 6 month disqualification. Of course, due to the OHP being closed to new enrollments as of last summer, the disqualification period is substantially longer than 6 months. The result of this has been a drastic increase in emergency room visits for routine care and prescription refill requests, resulting fragmentation or burdening other parts of the system. Since the inception of the premium disqualification penalty, many safety net providers are accessing prescription scholarships for indigent patients. In my clinic alone in Portland, we have seen a staggering 45% increase in needed prescription scholarships, results in about $60,000 a month in prescription scholarships we're providing. Know that the pharmaceutical companies are becoming wise to this, and monthly I've experienced their criteria tightening. Currently, the state is heavily marketing FEOP, Family Health Insurance Plan, as a viable alternative to those disqualified from Oregon Health Plan. It is not. FEOP is a subsidy that assists individuals, families, and small business to purchase commercial insurance. While in theory this is positive, it is not acceptable.
About a minute.
For the people that are disqualified, FEOP applicants are quickly approved for the subsidy and then denied by the commercial plans for pre-existing conditions. Once they're denied, they're then eligible for OMIP, which is the high-risk pool, which presents another problem that applicants cannot access prescriptions or other needed health care services for pre-existing conditions for 6 months, and in some cases permanently. The deductibles, the co-pays, are not something that they are able to do. If you can't pay a $6 premium, then you're not going to be able to pay a high deductible. While considering the elimination of the $6 level premium, I would also remind you that the premium processing company, William Earhart, receives $3.11 for each processed payment. Although eliminating the penalty for all premium levels is ideal, I would urge you to consider reinstating the waivable circumstances for those in need of permanent or temporary relief from premium responsibilities due to emergencies, homelessness, and domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Duke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
My name is John Duke, and I run a little homeless clinic in Portland called Outside In. I'm also the chair of the statewide healthcare safety net coalition and chair in Multnomah County of the Coalition of Community Health Clinics. Speaking to you today, I want to give you the personal experience of patients that I've met at our clinic who this bill will help, Senate Bill 824. But I also am speaking on behalf of the 72 safety net clinics around the state and the 13 federally qualified and community-sponsored clinics in Multnomah County. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 824. The people this bill helps are people who have incomes less than 11% of the federal poverty level. These are really poor people. They're making less than $80 a month. Someone that survives at that level tends to be homeless. They often have some sort of chronic mental illness or some crisis in their life that keeps them at that level of poverty. Someone that I've met like that is a woman named Betty, who we met at our Rose Haven medical outreach to Rose Haven Women's Shelter. She's a 50-year-old homeless woman. She lives in her car with her cat, and she eats at the Rose Haven Women's Shelter. She has diabetes, and she has a mental illness. For her, it's not just the cost of the premium, but it's the demand of a mailbox and the organization to pull together paying premiums each month that is almost impossible to overcome. Another patient that's impacted by this is a kid named Jason. He was raised in foster care and group homes, and at 18, he was cut loose to the streets to fend for himself. A youth like this is struggling to eat and to find shelter. He is struggling to avoid drugs and crime and all the other threats on the streets when someone's out there. All the things that plague the hundreds of homeless youth that are on the streets. He may not even know what day of the week it is. For him, paying a monthly premium is practical. The possibility of doing that is practically nil. It's in the state's interest to maintain coverage for these vulnerable folks. Fiscal management of the Oregon Health Plan can be maintained through other methods than cutting off the folks least able to advocate for themselves. So it's for these patients in my clinic and similar folks in the other clinics, the safety net clinics around the state, that I thank those that pulled this bill together, and I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Comments? It's very important. We're going to continue this conversation a week from today. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 824, and the committee is adjourned.